My name's Christina, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm so nervous, I can't take it. Oh, I can't take it. So when I got a call from Kat 2 years ago, I mean, it's so funny, they kind of just fuck you. She's like, hey, what are you doing? October, whatever, 2018. It's like, I don't know, like I can't think of an excuse as to why. I mean, I don't know anyone that plans their calendar out 2 years in advance. So I don't know how anybody says no. But I'm incredibly grateful to be here. It's been a wonderful weekend. I want to thank everybody that brought me out. I can't remember any of your names at the moment, but thank you for having me. It's such a beautiful place. I am from San Francisco, so this is all new to me. I've never been here, and I don't think I've ever met any of you except for Kat. I did meet some lovely friends last night in the restaurant. Thank you. They invited me to eat dinner with them, a lovely crew from here, so that was really kind. So I'd like to take a minute and welcome the new members, the ones that stood last night and maybe those that didn't. To the gentleman that had 2 days, welcome to your third. I'm incredibly grateful that you are here because my life depends on you. And if newcomers didn't walk in the door, then I wouldn't be able to pass on what it is that I have gained here that was freely given to me. There has to be somebody that I can turn around and pass it on to, or I don't stay sober. So thank you for walking in the door. I remember actually when an old timer had said that to me when I came in the door, and I remember thinking, if your life depends on me, I am so sorry. Like, you are such, like, really unfortunate, because I can't save my own life, let alone anyone else's. So I should say also to the newcomers, new members, that if you don't relate to anything that I say, I'm really happy for you. My story's dramatic, and I was a low-bottom drunk, as they say. There is not one thing that I did not lose to my relationship with alcohol, or one thing that I didn't give away because of my relationship with alcohol. So if you don't relate to what I say, or my story doesn't make any sense to you, then please do keep coming back, because I am one in millions. My story is my story, but what I have to share is the solution. That's what brings us here today. So my sobriety date is September 4th, 1993. So I just celebrated 25 years. Thank you. And in keeping with the obvious tradition here, my home group is Sunday night, 7 o'clock in San Francisco, Greenfield Beginners. It's an extraordinary meeting. I'm like one of the youngest with long-term sobriety, meaning my 25 years, and then newcomers. And it's an extraordinary group of service and experience and beauty. So that's 7 o'clock on Sundays. I came into these rooms when I was 21 years old, so I have spent half my life sober. In fact, I grew up in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the women in these rooms, and the men for that matter, but the women in these rooms taught me everything that I know, the way that I live, the way that I raise my children, the way that I work, the way I interact on the planet. I was taught in here, in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything that I am, how I move on the planet, is a reflection of growing up here. And when I say the women taught me everything I know, I mean everything. From writing rent checks to paying electricity to being kind and loving and graceful. How to be a friend, how to be in a relationship, how to be a daughter and a sister and a mother. I'm not quite sure. I cry when I'm nervous, so sorry. It's either crying or vomiting, so, you know. crying is far more attractive. When I walked through the doors, I actually kind of stumbled through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. My life was so dark, and I was so hopeless, and I hated myself. I hated what I had become. I hated being alive. I hated that I woke up every single day. I hated what I had done to myself and to my family. I had come to a place in my life where I literally had nowhere else to go but a jail, I suppose, an institution, or here. So that's how I arrived at AA. I will tell you a little bit about what happened, or what I was like and what happened, and what I'm like today. I had my first drink when I was 13, and what I can tell you is I'm painfully shy and really awkward, which likely the lovely people I had dinner with last night can tell you. I was sitting alone, which is generally, you know, my go-to safe place is alone. So when they asked me to come and join them, it's like, oh God, I really, you know, how you say yes, but really it's like, no. I'm really good by myself. So I'm very awkward and shy. So when I, the first time I drank, although I can't remember, I just remember how it felt. I can't remember the exact details of my life at that time, necessarily. I was 13, but I loved how I felt. It was the first time I felt like I ever exhaled. And the pain that I felt in my chest, or that tight feeling I felt in my chest, was relieved. And for the first time in my 13-year-old life, I felt peaceful. And I want you to know, I drank, you know, not because of peer pressure or anything like that. I come from a great family. I was loved and wanted. My dad is, or was, he passed away, but he was alcoholic. And so he came home, you know, he wore a three-piece suit. He came home every night. He loved my mom and all of us. I'm one of four. We had a good life. He was successful. It never occurred to me that that was an alcoholic. But alcohol was really important to him, and I found it really curious. And he made it look really attractive. He'd drink, like, whiskey, like, out of a, like, really cool glass, and it clinked around, and I don't know, it looked fancy. And I was really curious about it, so I stole liquor from their liquor cabinet and drank myself to sleep at the bushes at the end of their driveway, which was my first drink, which is funny, because I start in the bushes and end in the bushes. They just get less manicured along the way. And from the first time I drank, I loved how I felt. And what started for me then, I didn't know, or I didn't have the words for it, but what started for me then was this mad obsession, or this crazy love affair with alcohol, that I chased nearly, as they say, definitely to the gates of insanity and only steps away from a grave. But what started for me then was this crazy obsession. And I thought about alcohol, and I wanted to be with it. I wanted to do it again as much and as often as possible. So I was only 13, and I had to have my 13-year-old life. So I did go to school, and I had this swimming career, and I did that. So I don't know when it was exactly when I drank again, but whenever I could, I did. And I always stole liquor and drank myself to sleep at the bushes at the end of the driveway, which for this socially awkward person was perfection. Although I think if anyone had been there with me, I would have been, like, more socially normal. I did go to high school eventually for a day or two. I went to high school just long enough to be introduced to, like, boys and drugs. And, like, that happened really fast. I want you to know that. Like, my high school career was about 6 months. So I found drugs, and that allowed me to drink more, and everything that I've come across in my life that makes me feel better or different, I do obsessively or alcoholically. So in a matter of a year, I had dropped out of high school. I didn't go home anymore. All my friends were different, if I had any. And the only thing that was important to me was being intoxicated as much as I could. My mom, about this time, found a program called Al-Anon. Do we have any Al-Anoners in here? Okay, great. So hang with me, because I was really angry at y'all for like a while. So you got to hang with me, because there's an upswing at the end. However, my mom found this program called Al-Anon, and it ruined my fucking life. Like, she got a spine and a sponsor, and my life was over as I knew it. She used to stick these little sticky notes around. I don't know if they were for me or for her, but things like, you know, no is a complete sentence. And, you know, she used to walk around. I used to say she had this, like, Al-Anon float. She'd, like, walk around the house. She'd kind of float around the house, like, you know, nothing you can do is going to affect me. You know, you shithead child. She tried everything to help me before she found Al-Anon. Everything, you know, money can provide, therapy, psychiatry. She nailed my window shut, which I'm certain is illegal now that I have children. She begged, she pleaded. She did everything she could do. And then she found that program and things were over for me. You know, it's funny, she grounded me once to an AA meeting with my dad. My dad's from Texas, by the way, so he was this old cowboy, and he used to wear this cowboy hat and smoke cigars and wear cowboy boots. And then in San Francisco, that was, like, not normal. So she found Al-Anon, and my dad and I were sentenced to an AA meeting. It was my first AA meeting. I was 16. It was a meeting likely as large as this. Everyone was 180 years old, I'm sure. They all drove like Harley Davidsons. And oh, it's when you could smoke, too, in meetings, by the way. So there were, you know, 358 people over here. And then me and my dad, you know, on this side. It was a CHIP meeting, so you know, it's pretty amazing to bear witness to people collecting chips and celebrating time, even as out of my mind as I was. It was pretty extraordinary. And I remember looking over at my dad, and he had tears like streaming from his face. And you got to remember, my dad was like this tough cowboy. And I just thought, oh, my God, I've lost him. And he walked out of that meeting and never drank again. And he died with over 25 years sober. So, anyway, Al-Anon won that night, I guess. At least for one of us. But I walked out of that meeting and thought, there's no way I'm ever going there again. Like I said, I was 16. Everyone was really old. And you drank coffee and ate, like, stale cookies. And I just thought, this is so weird. This is so weird. So I walked out of that meeting swearing I would never return. And what happened over the course of the next few years as I was in and out of institutions, my mom would sit on my bedside and cry and beg me. She would beg me to stay in tonight. She would just cry and say, please, Christina, don't go out tonight. I just need a night's sleep. And as soon as she left my room out the window, I would go not to be seen or heard from again in days or weeks or months. And actually, this is going to make me sound really, really old, and I'm not old. But I got sober before, like, the internet or cell phones or, like, GPS tracking or any of that. So when I climbed out the window and disappeared, like, I was gone. My mom didn't know if I was dead or alive. And they would send me places, and I would always escape. I'm a great escape artist, constantly on the move, away. And, you know, all the speakers had spoken of this, actually, over the last weekend. But I was constantly headed somewhere, just somewhere. never actually knowing where, just headed there quickly, madly, and as fast as I could. So they would put me in these institutions. I don't know. They'd kidnap me. They didn't call it kidnapping. Like, I think Al-Anon called it, like, therapeutic intervention. But it was kidnapping. And you'd think I'd, like, get a clue anytime my parents wanted to go out to lunch with me. And the locks would go down. My dad was smoking his cigar. My mom was praying out of her Al-Anon book, and off we'd go someplace. The last place they took me was this place in Idaho, which had a lot of snow and women, neither of which I liked, and left me. And I have to tell you, it was the longest 18-hour drive of my life, as you might imagine, with my dad and my mom and me, 18 hours out in the middle of nowhere. However, 4 days later, I did find my way out. It was the coldest winter in 50 years. I want you to know, in San Francisco, it doesn't get cold like that. It also doesn't get dark like that, because there's always lights from buildings or, I don't know. I'd never seen so much darkness in my life. But I was set to escape, and my plan was, you know, I was never going to go back. I made my way back to California. I did go to my parents' door to, you know, grace them with my presence. And my mom came to the door, as they had changed the locks, you know, many, many times. And my mom came to the door in her Al-Anon type of way, floating around. And she said to me, Christina, you are no longer welcome in my home or in my life until you are living a life of recovery. And if I never see you alive again, I want you to know how much I love you. And she closed the door on me. And I figured that she was having like a high self-esteem Al-Anon day. And that she'd get over it. But it's been, I don't know, 28 years. And she has not gotten over it. So I wish I could say I got sober that day. I suppose would have saved me a lot of heartache, pain, and disaster, but I didn't. I was going to prove to my parents, my mom, and definitely her Al-Anon sponsor, that I did not need AA, and I did not need sobriety, and that I could do this. And I set out to have a little life, and I did for a little while. However, the only thing that was important to me was drinking. It became the most important relationship in my life. I mean, it became the most important thing in my life. I had little jobs here and there, but I only went to work on Wednesdays, which, I don't know, employers didn't appreciate. I only went to work on Wednesdays because I started drinking on Thursday, and then I lost a lot of time in the middle, and then I'd stop drinking on Tuesday, and then I'd go to work on Wednesday only to steal money from my coworkers and my employers so that I could continue to drink on Thursday. Nonetheless, as you might imagine, I got fired a lot. So after the last time I got fired, I went home to my, it was really a mattress kind of in a closet that I rented. And I sat there all night long, drinking, doing some other things, and drinking more. And I had to come up with some sort of employment that I could do, preferably at night. I could make my own schedule that I could do under the influence. And I came up with a list of two things. I could prostitute, or I could rob homes. And after much deliberation and many bottles of alcohol, I decided that that prostitution would be a lot of work. And, you know, it entails like human interaction and negotiating and like sweating. And I, you know, was not interested in any of that. So I decided to rob homes, and I engaged in 22 home invasions to support my habit. I didn't talk to my mom. I didn't call her or my family. I thought about them, though, every day. You know, it was an incredibly despairing time in my life and in my drinking. It's incredibly despairing. Alcoholism. Because I would wake up every day, every single day, for 3 years, and said to myself, I'm not going to drink today. And I meant it. I really meant it. I was going to be better. I was going to be sober. I was going to go back home. I was going to be a daughter, and I was going to get my life together every single day for 3 years, and every single day I drank. Somehow, some way, at the end of the day, I once again was completely intoxicated. So it was such a hopeless time that I knew better and I wanted to live better, but I was incapable of doing better. I'd robbed these homes. I hated myself. I hated what I'd become. By the way, home invasions, highly stressful. So I retired. Quickly, figure it's a great way to be shot in the face, or I don't know. I didn't want any of that, and I didn't mean to hurt anyone. I just needed to be intoxicated. So I retired from home invasion, and I didn't know. I got into this place where all I knew how to do was drink. That was it. That was all I did. And so I headed off into the city where all the homeless people go. There's like an 8-block radius in San Francisco where, all the drug addicts live. And I proceeded to live out my days of addiction homeless. I don't know how it is or where it was. What drink it was that alcohol became the most important thing to me. But as I said earlier, it did. I don't think I drew a sober breath for as long as I was there. Homelessness is incredibly cold, incredibly lonely. Actually, it's like being invisible. Because people step over you. They pretend to see you, but they don't really. And I remember when people would step over me and drop money in my styrofoam cup when they used to have them, by the way. They don't anymore. I remember thinking, if you could just see me, I don't belong here. I didn't mean for any of this to happen. I didn't mean for any of this to happen. I think about my mom. My mom always offered help. And I think about her offer of help at the door that day, 3 years earlier, by the way. I just figured I'd gone too far to ever come out. There is not one thing I have not done to support my habit. And I just figured I went too far to come out. I didn't know how I would ever live a normal life. It was so beyond my capability of thought that I could ever come back from what I had done. My last drink was September 4th, 1993. I did not know it was going to be my last drink, by the way. I didn't intend on that. I didn't wake up that day with this moment of clarity that today was the day I was going to get sober. It didn't happen that way. But I drank the bottle dry. I found in a dumpster, by the way, chocolate liqueur, which I know why it was in the dumpster. But anyway, I was stumbling down the sidewalk, and I think my plan was I was going to throw myself on the oncoming traffic on Van Ness in San Francisco. Anyway, I was arrested for being drunk and disorderly. Which is funny, since I robbed 22 homes. So they got me, and they put me in a homeless shelter on a 6-hour hold. And it was on the floor of this shelter that I had my moment of clarity, spiritual awakening. I whatever you want to call it, on the floor of this homeless shelter, I was dying. And I knew I was dying. And I was not afraid of dying. I'd been waiting and expecting and inviting it for years. It wasn't the dying that woke me up. It was the terrible regret. It was the terrible regret that was suffocating me. My body was failing, but I was being suffocated by this terrible regret that I'd done this to myself, that I'd done this to my family, that I didn't mean it. And if I could just somehow have a do-over, I could make it different. I could do it different. I was 21 years old, and I had plans. I was going to go to college on a swimming scholarship. I was going to write a book, study psychology. I was going to make my parents proud. I was going to be somebody, and I was going to do something, and I was going to go somewhere. I didn't mean for this to happen. And the last thought I remember having was how sad my mom will be that it ended this way. And I close my eyes to die. Saving you the suspense. I didn't die. I did come out of that homeless shelter, but I was different. I came out of that homeless shelter, and for the first time, and I don't know, maybe forever, I didn't know what to do. I used to have all the answers. You were wrong, and I was right. That was my answer. It was always everyone else's fault, and I was always right. And I came out of that homeless shelter literally standing on a street corner, and I didn't know what to do. But how I felt was, if I didn't drink, I was going to die. And if I drank, I was going to die. What I know today is it's called that jumping off place that they speak of in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I had no idea what to do. I used to be overcome with panic. Like this panic would creep in the back of my throat, and I felt like I couldn't breathe when I didn't know where I was going to get the next, whatever the next was. And on this street corner, I was filled with panic that I'd never known before, and fear. And not knowing what else to do, I called my mom. And my mom said, "Are you calling for treatment?" And I said, "I am." And she said, "Here's the name of a shelter and a center that you can go to. Good luck." And she hung up the phone. Now, what's funny about that is somehow in my alcoholic mind, I figured that she and my three siblings and my dad, that they were all waiting around the phone for 3 years for me to call. But they weren't waiting for me anymore. Nobody actually waited for me anymore. Nobody expected anything from me anymore. So I did go to treatment. I was driven there with the clothes on my back by the police officer that arrested me. It was a, 30-day program, I suppose. I stayed half a year. I know. Took me about 90 days to arrive. And treatment was incredibly valuable to me. I mean, it got me off the street. It fed me. I could sleep. It was warm. However, I don't consider treatment recovery. I think treatment is just what it is, medical care. Kind of like intensive care, I guess. The best thing that happened to me in that treatment center was I was introduced to, once again, the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I left that center, I moved into a van. It didn't drive or turn on, but coming from this street, it felt really nice. So I lived in this van. Do you know how many hours there are in a day when you live in a van? And you're not supposed to drink or commit crime. And you have no friends or family. A lot of hours. So in San Francisco, actually in Marin County, there's a place called the Alano Club. They seem to have them, well, I know they do, all over the country. They're called different things, but essentially it's this club where they have AA meetings all day long, and they have food, the greatest food, but they have food and coffee and sober people. And they have meetings literally all day from 6 a.m. to 11 p.m. It's like a shelter for AA people. So I lived in this van and I didn't know where else to go. So I went to this place and I went to meetings all day long, like 3 or 4 a day. And I didn't come here to get sober, I want you to know. I did not come here to be sober 25 years. I went to that place and I went to those meetings because I did not literally have anywhere else to go, and I didn't want to die the alcoholic death that I knew. I figured that giving up, maybe smoking crack wasn't going to, lead to like a lifelong, happiness or whatever. So I figured giving up all that was probably good. But giving up alcohol, I was 21. Like, who does that? I could not fathom my life without alcohol. So I went to these meetings. And I went to these meetings because I didn't have anything else to do. But I also went to these meetings because when I walked in the door, my life was really awful. I lived in a van. I didn't have anybody. My family didn't talk to me. I didn't have any friends. I had nothing. I hadn't worked an honest day ever. I didn't have a high school education. I had nothing. But I walked in that room. I didn't have clothes. I didn't have anything. But I walked in that room, and my life hurt less. It's like my heart hurt less for that 1 hour, for reasons I still can't quite explain today. However, maybe make some guesses. But I walked in that room, and my heart hurt less. But when I walked out of that room, my life still sucked. It's not like I was unhomeless magically. But I kept going as much as I could because I hurt less. I also kept going because people were kind. And I cannot tell you how many years it had been since anyone was kind to me. You saved me a seat, and you weren't afraid of what I had become. You didn't care that I was angry or that I spit or swore or lived in a van or had to wear the same clothes every day and shower like wherever I could. You didn't care. You were kind. And you said things like, keep coming back. So I did. I got a sponsor. I don't know how. I don't remember. I'm sure she lost a bet or something. I do that to my sponsees today. Like, hey, you got the homeless chick. So I'm sure she lost a bet, but she was so amazing. She was like 24. She'd been sober since she was like 18. And she was so beautiful. She had this blonde hair and she kind of glowed. I don't know. And when she talked, I found myself listening. And she was unafraid. She came to meet with me in the van and we worked, started reading the book and we worked the steps together. That one relationship changed my life. She taught me about unconditional love, friendship, loyalty, in a way that I had never known before. She was my sponsor for a decade, until she moved away. But she used to say things to me, like I got sober and things like, I don't know, old timers are really super, super intense. And she'd say things like, and all the old timers, I was going to say old people, but old timers in the room, they'd say things like, don't drink no matter what and go to meetings. Don't drink no matter what and go to meetings. And I remember when Tanya told that to me and I was like, you know, you got to have a bigger plan than that. Cause I don't know, I'm really messed up. Like, you gotta have like some, like, tell me the secret. Like, you gotta let me in on this club thing that you guys got, cause that cannot be the plan. And she just kept saying, it was like, and that was just what I needed, you know, just like super simple. Don't drink no matter what and go to meetings. And I want you to know, 25 years later, I do exactly the same thing today as I did back then. I didn't drink or I don't drink. I go to meetings. I read the book. I meet with my sponsor. I help newcomers, right? She told me that. You listen to old timers and you put your hand out to newcomers. Every meeting, you put your hand out to a newcomer and you listen to an old timer. So I did. And we worked the steps, and my life began to change in really amazing ways. You know, coming back from homelessness was it's incredibly difficult. You know, I felt invisible for years being homeless. And I always had this feeling, as I said, that, I don't know, it's really hard to be nobody and to get somebody to pay attention. I just needed somebody to see me and help me. And I knew that somehow I could be different. And she was my somebody. She saw me. She believed. And she loved me. Coming back from homelessness, as I said, is incredibly hard. You know, I didn't have a driver's license or a high school diploma or an address or references. Like, I knew better than to put, like, home invasion manager on my application. Although if you knew how hard it was to manage, like, 4 meth heads in the middle of the night in a house without getting caught, like, you'd hire me to do anything. I could run any company ever. But nonetheless, really hard to come back from homelessness. I could not find a job. Nobody would help. I couldn't get out. And I wanted to drink every day. I wanted to drink every single day. I'm not one of those people that walked in the doors and the desire to drink was lifted. I wanted to drink. I was having trouble, a lot of trouble seeing how this was going to work out for me. But like Tanya said, I didn't drink, I went to meetings, I worked the steps. I did finally get a job in a coffee shop. And I got that job because the gentleman that owned it, you know, had come from another country. And he said he knows, you know, he said, I know how it feels to not get a chance. So you can work for me. And I expect you to be here every day, not to steal from me. So I did. I showed up every day. The most important job I have ever had in my life. And my jobs have gotten profoundly better over the years. But that job was the most important, significant job of my life. I went every single day. I made coffee. He helped me. He'd write me. I didn't have a bank account. I couldn't have a bank account. So he'd pay me in cash. And eventually I made my way out of that van. And I began to put my life back together. I put myself through school one class at a time. Got my high school diploma. I went on to study at Berkeley. Finished there. Opened a business. I'm actually like an addiction consultant. I think that's so funny. Like, I don't really actually know what that is. I kind of made it up in true alcoholic form. But, you know, people believe me. For the last 23 years, people have believed me. I've been on Good Morning America, sitting across from George Stephanopoulos and Robin Roberts, and they're like, wow, you know, you're an addictions person. Yeah, totally. So, I don't know. I just keep showing up. So, when I got to the eighth and ninth step, I really struggled with the houses that I robbed. I felt very small in my life at that time. I felt like I was always going to be defined as an addict and an alcoholic, and that I was somehow bound to this past I could not get away from. So I struggled a lot with it, and I asked my sponsor about it, and she told me to pray, which now that I'm a sponsor, I know that means I have no fucking idea what to tell you, so pray. So I did. I prayed about it, and then the answer came to me in the middle of the night. One night, I woke up and I knew exactly what I needed to do. If I wanted to be free, if I wanted to forgive myself, if I was going to find peace with myself, I needed to make peace with them. So I proceeded to knock on each of the 22 doors that I robbed. And at the end of that time, you know, the ninth step promises, as they say, I felt more free than I ever had in my life. I felt that I was free of those chains that bound me to this story, to this experience, and that I could rewrite, right? That I could author my own life, that me and God could do this together, and I could be and do anything that I wanted. And so I did. As I said, I educated myself, and I did write a book, and with my mom, actually. My mom and I co-authored a book together, and we traveled this country. And I don't know, my mom is a hero to so many people. In fact, when I'm asked what was the turning point in my drinking, I have to say, if I'm really honest, behind it all, that the groundwork of my recovery was Al-Anon. Because that program taught my mom how to love me enough to let me go. And I'd be dead today if it weren't for that program. So Mom and I travel. It's been an amazing experience for me to watch what a hero she is. People stand in line to meet her. I know this because nobody's in my line because they're all mad at me. So I just watch in amazement at the difference my mom is making on the planet. So I've done amazing things in my sobriety, and for the first many years, like 18 years, life was good. It was good, and I believed, right? I believed that if I did good in the world and I sponsored 8 million people and I went to meetings all the time, that in return life would be good to me, that God would be good to me. And it was that way for 18 years. So my sobriety date is September 4th. On September 5th, 2011, my husband put a gun to his head and pulled the trigger. He got addicted a few years before. He had a back surgery and got addicted to pain medication. And that's how it ended for him. And with a pull of a trigger, my life was annihilated. I was annihilated. And my children were obliterated. And I couldn't reckon it. And I went into what I would call a faith crisis. What I realized is that for the first 18 years of my sobriety, I had this spiritual contract. And the contract was I would do good, and then God would be good. And on that day, the contract was broken. And I lost my way. And everything that I thought about myself and my life and God and my relationship with God, he blew a hole straight through. And the thing is, like, I can take it, I felt like, right? Like, I got this somehow. But I couldn't make sense of it for my children, who were 9 and 11. And they loved their father. And their father loved them. didn't drink, and I went to meetings. I didn't drink, I went to meetings. No matter what, that's what I did. And it took a little while, but I began to rebuild my relationship with God. It took a while, actually, a long while, 3 years, to be exact. In fact, I fired my sponsees, I fired my sponsor, I got really quiet, I withdrew, but I went to meetings. Because that's what I knew how to do. That's all I knew how to do. And as a sober woman, that's what we do. We don't drink no matter what. So I went to meetings. However, it's very painful to feel lost and not be new. Like, I felt new, but I wasn't. I had 18 years. But I began to restructure my faith. I did get a new sponsor. And I did begin to work the steps again, and I began to build a relationship with God without the contractual agreement. And I watched my children begin to heal. It was really my children in many ways that led the way for me, oddly. I watched them struggle with their faith, with God, ask really hard questions. My daughter, who has this incredibly high emotional IQ and is from certainly a different planet, she's oftentimes the adult in our relationship. So I saw her struggle and ask really hard things. Like, if suicide is a sin and Dad is in hell, then does that mean I'll never see him in heaven? So nonetheless, onward I went. I slowly came back to life, I would say, and rebuilt this relationship with God. I saw my children recover, because that's what children do. My daughter came to me one day, a turning point for me was my daughter came to me one day and she said, Mama. She said, Mama, I got it. She said, maybe life is like a slumber party. And when it's over, it's time to go home. And maybe it was just Dad's time to go home. So I stand before you. I've learned a lot from my children. I've learned from this program. I've learned how to stay sober when it hurts so badly I could barely breathe. I've learned how to show up even though I don't want to. I've learned how to tell the truth even when I don't want to. And I've learned how to keep coming back even when I don't want to. I believe in so many ways, like my daughter said, Savannah is her name. She said, as she said about her father, that we are all ultimately here to walk each other home. And for reasons I don't quite understand, it was his time to go. I don't know exactly what happens, by the way, in these rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, how we can all come together and there's some magical strength in here that I have found nowhere else in my life. And that there's some grace that falls upon us all when we gather. Not on one individual's shoulder, but as a collective whole. And I believe, and what I learned, is that if grace can befall you, it can befall me, and that God is either everywhere or he is nowhere. And I can't believe that God works in your life and not see God in mine. And that this wasn't done to me, but that God has allowed me the strength to come through. So I believe today that I am no more important or less than the person next to me. I believe in a life of purpose, passion, and meaning. I believe getting up every morning and asking myself how I can be of service today, how I can make the lives of the people that I love better and the lives of the people that I don't know better. as long as I can remember. As long as I can remember, I burned with this fury inside, this desperation to be somebody, to make a difference in the world, to get somewhere. I burned with this fury to get somewhere, and every time I arrived to where I thought I was meant to be, I was left with even more desperation. And as a result of working the 12 steps, I realized I was never going somewhere, but I was going back to the beginning, where it was me and God, and it was perfect and simple and clear. And what I know today, after all this time, is that the person that I was always meant to be was an alcoholic. And my purpose was always meant to be of service. And I was never on a journey somewhere, but on a journey home to you. So I stand in front of you, somebody that is incredibly grateful. I am grateful that I had nowhere else to go. I want you to know also that when I look at my children today, who are now 16 and 18, you know, I always feel moved to thank you all, even though I don't know you and probably won't see most of you ever again along the way. But I always feel like I want to thank you because I look at my children and they are a reflection of every single one of you. They are a reflection of this program, what I learned here, how I grew up here. I carry all of you with me in all of my life, in all of my days. I never came here thinking that I would be sober. I really didn't. I never thought it was possible. So to the new people in the room, as I said, those that introduced yourself or stood, and those of you that didn't, and maybe those of you that aren't new but feel new, if you never want to drink again, you don't have to. If you hear nothing else I say, you don't even have to believe in God to stay sober. You just have to keep coming. And belief has a strange way of growing when you least expect it. The way I figure, and actually it was said last night, so forgive me, but I say, I don't know where he went, but I say something very similar, that I get a front row seat. This is how I spend my life. I get a front row seat to watching people redeem themselves. That's what it is here. For 25 years, I have sat and watched the most miraculous things happen. And I am so grateful that this is my life. So in leaving or closing, and both leaving and closing, I want to thank you all, as I said, for my sobriety, for my recovery. Thank you for coming, for listening, for helping me to raise my children, to make peace with my family, to make peace with myself, to find a God in my life. I don't really know how to end it. So anyway, thank you for coming. It's such a pleasure to be here. Thank you.